Welcome to Book It,
a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books. Book It is hosted by the Blue Manatee Literacy Project,
a nonprofit that operates an independent bookstore in Cincinnati, Ohio.
When you shop with Blue Manatee, you are giving back to the community. For every book purchased, BMLP donates a book to a child in need.
Book It is hosted by me, Michael Woodson.
And me, Jill Burkett-Ragacy.
My husband is taking his lunch right now, and when he takes his lunch, he just puts in his headphones and plays some Star Wars game that I couldn't even begin to explain to you.
Are we married to the same person?
Is that what happened? Is that what's happening to you?
It's either he puts in his headphones and plays a video game, or he puts in his headphones and watches some kind of progressive rock documentary.
Oh, sure. Well, Josh doesn't do that, but he is frequently, any free time he has, he puts his headphones in and plays these two Star Wars games that he loves. And it's something that I usually don't witness, because it's like, if I work a shift in the bookstore on a weekend, that's when he plays it. Or like, he wakes up before me for work, so he plays it then. And it's just been a education. I mean, he's so, you know, Josh, like, he's so lovely and he's so kind to everyone and like probably the best of all of us. And then he plays his video games and he is so competitive and someone I don't recognize. I love you, Josh. Love you, honey.
I love that story.
So here we are again. Week, what is it?
I don't even know. My children were last at school on March 13th. It was Friday the 13th. Something that's not lost on me.
We were saying before we started that when this all started, I was wearing a coat to work. And now I'm in, well, to be perfectly honest, I'm in, these pants have buttons on them. So I don't call them pajama pants, but they are basically pajama pants.
Yes. I was realizing this morning that I was a little bit sad that I don't have a yoga pant equivalent in shorts.
Yeah.
All my
would that just be like bike shorts?
I that feels really compression-y.
Yeah, that feels really uncomfortable. Oh, well, welcome to Book It, everyone. It is, at this point when you're listening to this, it's officially summer. Short season, as we like to call it. And getting started with this episode, I wanted to read from one of my favorite books, if you don't mind, Jill.
I'm excited.
So this is Another Brooklyn by Jacqueline Woodson. And it's a book about, basically it's about friendship, and it's about this one woman who's looking back on this friendship she had with these three girls in Brooklyn in the 1970s. And I think it's a really great representation of the conversation we had that we're leading into later. So I'm going to go ahead and read from it now. The main character's name is August. Before they were mine, I stared at their necks, watched their perfect hands close around jump ropes and handballs, saw their brightly polished nails. As they grabbed each other's arms and bounce walked down the hall, I was sure no ghost mothers existed in their pasts. I truly believed they were standing steadily in the world. I watched them, wanting to have what they had, 6 feet planted, right here, right now. That year, before we all grew to one height, Sylvia was the tallest. The day we finally became friends, Angela wore a too small coat, her thin pale arms protruding from the sleeves. My own jacket was also too small, so I met her eyes first, hoping she'd see we came from the same place. A place where we cornrowed our hair and were unprepared for how quickly winter settled over the city. The sadness and strangeness I felt was deeper than any feeling I'd ever known. I was 11. The idea of two identical digits in my age still new and spectacular and heartbreaking. The girls must have felt this. They must have known. Where had 10, 9, 8, and 7 gone? And now the four of us were standing together for the first time. It must have felt like a beginning, an anchoring. I held my nearly flat book bag with both hands. "Why do you stare at us like that?" Sylvia said. "What are you looking for?" Years later, I'd remember how shaky her voice was, how I wondered if it was the cold or fear that made it quiver. And in it, there was the slight lilt of Martinique, an island as foreign to me as the Bronx. Sylvia came closer to me. "Really, I'm asking, what are you seeing when you look at us? I'm not trying to be mean." "Everything," I said. "I see everything."
Wow.
And I think that this is my favorite book by Jacqueline Woodson, and it's the first book that I read of hers, which also might have something to do with why it's my favorite, because it really just affected me in a way that I wasn't prepared for. And I also think it's a great representation of why Jacqueline Woodson is so good at writing for all ages. Because this is a book for adults, and she is taking so seriously the impact of childhood friendship, specifically female friendship.
Yeah, I was struck by, I mean, I suppose it's universal, but it is something you begin feeling as a child. And when you go to make connections with people and make friends, you look for things that are the same.
Mm.
And so when she says, you know, I was looking, my coat was too small, and I was looking and saying, you know, this is the thing that we share. Isn't that how we all start? And I think we do it as adults too.
I think we do too. I think unconsciously we do that too. And I love the, like, a heartbreaking aspect of the idea of getting older and that starting quite young. Like the idea of these, like, 11, like that feels really significant. And then, like, recognizing, like, I'm about to be a teenager. My innocence is leaving me. And the idea that, like, one of them was the tallest, and that the small ways that we reflect upon childhood and that we forget about and what that does to us. And I think that Jacqueline Woodson is so patient with young readers and therefore really patient with her young characters. And I think that she just offers them a lot of respect that is, I think, sometimes missing. And I think that for better or for worse, I love YA, but I think a lot of young adult writing gets young people wrong, because I think I've said this before, I think in an effort to not belittle them, they're sometimes given, like, way too vast and beautiful of vocabularies and are just, like, wise beyond their years. And I think that her writing benefits from really understanding children and understanding what childhood has done to all of us at the same time.
I agree. I was rereading Each Kindness over the weekend, and I was really struck by the little girl in that story. Chloe reaches out and to play with the other kids on the playground, and she has one of those bouncy balls, like the super balls. And she says, you know, oh, it bounces so high. And she's trying to make a connection with the other girls. But they don't see the connection. They see her as different and other. And so they don't reach out and form the friendship there. You know, a different age group, but the same thing. We're all looking for this connection. But Jacqueline Woodson, she gets it. She gets it when you're in first grade, and she gets it when you're 11, and she gets it when you're, you know, 20 or 30 or 40.
We had the pleasure to interview Jacqueline Woodson, and something that we both recognize in all of her work, regardless of the age group she's writing for, is the amount of respect and empathy she shows to the characters that she's writing and the possible reader. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the biggest difference, is that she's equally empathetic for all characters, despite their age. To your point, with Each Kindness, that's a picture book. And I just read from Another Brooklyn, which is a book catered to adults. And I feel very similarly when I read her work, because it is so empathetic and mm-hmm. so patient and comes from a place of, I think, hope.
Yes. So in Each Kindness, and also in the other picture book, I really like The Day You Begin, it would be easy to make the book very didactic. And I think you see that a lot in the market, of saying, you know, the kids who aren't being kind are quote unquote bad.
Right.
And especially in Each Kindness, she goes, I think she says, you know, no, we're looking for things that are, we are looking for friendship, we're looking for similarities, and we didn't see it, and we're going to address it. And in Red to the Bone, which is an adult book, she has so much empathy for Iris, who abandons her child, for lack of a better description. I mean, it's not that cut and dry, but to the point, you know, it's... But she presents them all in a way that, regardless of their age, she's empathetic to them. They're presented complexly. But also, you we talked with her also about windows, and you can really see a glimpse, a perspective, a bit about what it feels like to be various characters regardless of age.
Yeah.
I feel like after our conversation with her, I went back and I reread some chunks of Red at the Bone, and I reread Each Kindness and The Day We Begin and Harbor Me after we talked to her last week, through the lens of the empathy.
Yeah.
And it was really impactful.
Yeah. And I like what you said about the character of Iris, because you're right. It isn't so cut and dry as she abandons her child, but to her child, it is that cut and dry. And I think that, again, that is a testament to her ability to empathize with two different perspectives, you know, like for Iris, it's not that simple, but for her daughter, it is. And we get both of those.
And even in reading it, I mean, I texted you at like 2 o'clock in the morning when I finished the book. And I said, "Why? I don't feel any empathy for this character. I don't care for her." Ugh.
Yes, you typed that last part out.
You gently pushed back. But then when we talked about it the next day, just sleeping on it, I woke up and I was like, you know what? That was a gut reaction. Mm. And it was not thinking on it very deeply. And actually,
That's also what I love about her books, is it offers reflection and kind of a slow burn response to it is best. But I also I agree with you. After we talked to her about Red at the Bone and Iris specifically, it just I understood her so much more, and maybe not understood her, but understood her motives and why she did the things she did. And I think that's a gift when you can have a reader literally sleep on something and wake up with a different perspective. Mm-hmm. So we had the absolute pleasure of interviewing Jacqueline Woodson. She is a multi-award-winning novelist of books ranging from picture book to books for adults. So here's that interview.
Jacqueline Woodson is the recipient of the 2020 Hans Christian Andersen Award, the 2018 Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award, and the 2018 Children's Literature Legacy Award. She was the 2018 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, and in 2015, she was named Young People's Poet Laureate by the Poetry Foundation. She received the 2014 National Book Award for her New York Times bestselling memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, which was also a recipient of the Coretta Scott King Award, a Newbery Honor, the NAACP Image Award, and a Seibert Honor. She wrote the adult book Red at the Bone, a New York Times bestseller, and Another Brooklyn, a 2016 National Book Award finalist. She's the author of dozens of award-winning books for young adults, middle grade, and children. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So, Jacqueline, today we really wanted to talk to you about sort of the process of writing for all ages, and just how unique with your stories that is, in terms of if you're writing a book for middle grade or young adult or adult, the seriousness and the level of respect you give to your reader is 100% the whole way. And most recently, you published Red at the Bone, a book of fiction for adults. And this coming September, you'll be coming out with Before the Ever After, which is, I just finished the arc yesterday and I couldn't talk to my husband about it without literally sobbing. And I was wondering, when you're working for different readers in that way, do you oscillate between the two, or do you finish a project and then come to the next one? And how do you know the age for the books you're writing?
Those are good questions. And it really, I'm starting to think of it as you know, BC and AC, before COVID and after COVID.
Yep.
Because I feel like my writing style, not my writing style, but my writing practice has really shifted in terms of, it used to be that I'd be working on everything at once. So I'd be working on a novel for adults, I'd be working on a novel for middle graders, and maybe a picture book and an article. And I just go from one to the other, depending on where my interest was in the moment or when the deadline was. But I definitely was only working on stuff I really deeply cared about. I can't work on something that I don't have interest in. So I can't write on spec. I mean, I can't even with the New York Times article about Ghana, like the reason that I wanted to write that article from a specific lens, a very specific lens. And I think if they had a sign, just go there and be a regular travel writer, I wouldn't have been able to do it. So I have to be deeply invested in the work. And with Red at the Bone, I know I was working on The Day You Begin at some point. Red at the Bone took me about 3.5 years to write. So so during that arc, I have to shift gears just to keep that interest up. And I usually do know pretty early on if it's going to be a picture book. A picture book, when I'm writing that, it's more like a poem. And the line breaks are very intentional. What each line reveals is very intentional because it's much more visual. As opposed to when I'm writing middle grade, that's not in verse. There's an immediacy to it. Like when you look at something like Harbor Me, I think they took my boppy. One of the first lines in the book. And for me, that I knew that those kids were going to be 10, 11 years old, just because of the cadence of the voices that were, coming to my head. So it really varies. And now with now that we're writing in this time of isolation, me with two young people in the house, I have to have a different kind of intentionality. Like I have to get up and say, okay, from 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. till noon, you have to be on your writing game because your mommy game and your writing game are very kind of merged now, as Jill was saying. Whereas before I would get up, everyone, my partner's a physician and she and my son were out of the house by 7:30. And Toshi, our daughter, was out of the house by 7:45. So I had from that time till like 7 p.m. pretty much, because I always think of, sports as extended day programs for the kids. Yeah. And so they were both fencing or doing their after school gigs. And so I had a full day before I had to put on the mommy hat and start thinking about dinner and stuff like that. And that's very different now. So the writing has shifted. The way I write has shifted.
I wanted to talk to you about, just in general, because it feels like you're publishing something new all of the time, and I'm just so impressed by it. And let's talk a little bit about Before the Ever After and your process of writing that story. How did you decide you wanted to write about the subject matter that you wrote about, and then how did you decide you wanted to write in verse? Because when you talk about Brown Girl Dreaming, you've said that's how memory comes to you, and I think that is so true and powerful, especially since that's a memoir. How did you approach writing in verse for Before the Ever After?
Sort of along the same lines, it's about the losing of memory and the trying to hold on to it, to the pieces of it. So again, that wouldn't have worked in narrative, because that's not what's happening with CJ's dad. And so in the case of Before the Ever After, CJ is trying to take all of these moments that he remembers and just keep them, because he's watching what his dad is going through. And I think a lot about people who are dealing with, people who have Alzheimer's or dementia or, even traumatic brain injuries, like the way they hold on is through these bits and pieces. And the idea of a longer narrative is a work in progress. It's going to require, especially for traumatic brain injuries, people to do a lot of rehab. And for ZJ at that age, at 11, this is what he sees, these small moments of his dad's life and the moments that he remembers. And my friend Toshi Regan is an avid football fan, football to the bone. She can tell you the stats back to the beginning of the game's history, basically, and just loves football. Whereas Juliet, my partner, was like, no child of ours will ever play football, because as a physician, she's seen in game. And I think around the time, maybe it was before the whole Take a Knee movement, I really started thinking about what this sport means to our country, how beloved it is, and how much a part of our fabric it is. and also about the trauma of it and the way so many families have been destroyed because of it in so many ways. But for so many, it's the only dream, right? It's a way out. Right. And so it's a very complicated history around Black and brown bodies, really, because, mm-hmm. you know, they get sold, they get beaten, they get, you know, broken, and then more are brought into the game. So I really wanted to investigate that from the point of view of a young person whose father is his hero. And it's, of course, with writing for young people, you always have to find the hope in the story. And so the writing and the rewriting of Before the Ever After helped me to investigate all of that.
Yeah. If you wanted to, since it's not out yet, if you wanted to really briefly give a synopsis of what our listeners can expect from Before the Ever After.
So Before the Ever After is a story of CJ, whose dad is a professional football player. And he starts behaving strangely. And it's in the late 90s, early 2000s, before we knew what CTE was. And it's an investigation of that. But it's basically the story of a boy and his father.
I think that's what I love most about your writing, is that what it's about is sort of like not necessarily what it's about. It's always about the relationships and the emotional impact of like mm-hmm. what the characters are going through. And even down to like, if we're talking about age groups here, when we had, it was big when The Day You Begin came out, was that 2 years ago?
Yes, I think
we
so.
Had our, the Blue Man.
Yeah.
Yes. Going into school, I believe. And the Blue Manatee Literacy Project in its former life was primarily a children's bookstore. So it was huge when that book came out. And it's a pretty, I want to say, like, mature concept, like for 6 or 7 year olds to be like, have pride in who you are, because like that's all you have right now. And Joe, do you remember really when that book came out and the impact it had on our customers?
Yeah, I would almost go back if we could, before we talk about that, and talk briefly about Each Kindness.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because I was telling Michael that this was the book I went to after the election in 2016, and I just felt like the rejected friend. And it was as if America had stood together and decided to reject like everything I hold closely. And it was the book I read to my kids. I hand sold it when people came in and said they were reading in their kids' classrooms. And it was just this balm to me. And then The Day You Begin came out, and I felt those feelings like, but slightly different. And this kindness and respect is the beginning and not the end. And I don't know where I'm going with a question, but
just more like, we can't stop praising you. Well, but I see what you're saying. It feels a little like almost full circle, but the idea of like with pain comes, I mean, what you were saying, Jacqueline, like you have to end with hope in some way.
Mm-hmm. It is true. I mean, you know, it's the reason we get up every morning, right? We have the sense that something good is going to come of the new day. And I think this is where kids live all the time. So it's important to respect that. And I feel like I get my own hope from seeing the way young people are so resilient and so able to keep on moving through what we consider devastating times or devastating mm-hmm. experiences, and really are so forgiving of each other and just really see each other in this way that I feel like once we become adults, we unlearn how to do.
Yeah, and it's another version of just like tackling those difficult conversations. And I mean, if we're talking to adults or kids, and mm-hmm. even if you think about Red at the Bone, it's told from various perspectives, and those perspectives also range in age mm-hmm. and life experiences. But also I recently read If You Come Softly for the first time, and that book came out over 20 years ago now.
Yeah, 1998.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I think the thing that really made me really emotional was how relevant it still was, and how we, I think every generation kind of thinks they're the first to experience something. And it really just affected me that it was a read that was sort of like, look how far we've come and just look how far we have yet to go. And I was really touched by your preface when you said that a lot of people have come up to you having read that book and that book meaning so much to them and their partner or whatever they're going through. And I was just wondering, like, that reads like a book that was so about a moment, but did you have any idea that it would continue to be relevant 20 years later?
I had hoped it wouldn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I had hoped that things would change, and they did change. And I mean, the way they changed is that we got social media, and the internet really started blowing up. And it wasn't just the experience of one group of people who knew this was going on, because it was happening in their own communities. It became the experience of a country and the world, and people starting to realize the deep injustice that people of color face in the many deep injustices. So I feel like, you know, Jeremiah and Ellie were, for me, something that was always known, and to the point that I was surprised in my own insular way that it wasn't a universal knowledge of this going on. But what has changed is that a lot more people know about it. But the numbers haven't changed, and that's
exactly.
I mean, thankfully, what was it? Was it this year or 2019? They passed the anti-lynching bill. It was like, duh, finally.
Gosh, way too recently,
Yeah, and then four people were against it. I mean, it's bananas, but I had hope that, and I think there are ways in which our country, especially young people, are starting to see. I mean, when you look at queerness, right? I don't know if you listened to the audiobook of Harbor Me. At one point, my son and I are talking, and I said, you know, some people have two moms, some people have two dads, some people have, you know, their grandparents raising them. He's like, well, what about gender non-binary people, mom? You didn't mention them. And that's something that I would never have imagined in 1998, that young people, and it's not just because he's being raised in his family, but young people have such a consciousness about the injustices that the LGBTQI communities face, and they're like, what is wrong? Like, I remember we were watching the Queen, the movie about Queen, and my partner was explaining that he wasn't allowed to be out, and both the kids were like, what? What do you mean he can't say that? Who tell people who he loves? And so that shift I've watched happen, but in terms of the racial divide, I feel like, of course, now it's being, you know, stoked and really a whole next level of things going on. But when I was writing If You Come Softly, I did hope that one day it would be a book that was not timely. You know, and when I was writing it, people were like, well, this would never happen. Like, people outside of Black and brown communities. And Black and brown communities were like, wow, you know, this is happening all the time. And now that conversation is different.
You mentioned queerness, and I think that's an interesting point, especially within If You Come Softly, because Ellie's sister identifies as gay, I believe, or queer. And she isn't great about the fact that Ellie is dating a Black boy. And I think that is just a layered issue, that that you have gone through something doesn't exempt you from having the wrong reaction. Mm-hmm. And in your Writer's Digest interview that you had a couple of years ago, you mentioned the idea of mirrors and windows. And it says, readers need mirrors to see reflections of themselves in literature, which is reaffirming, but they also need a window to see how the other lives. And I think that If You Come Softly is a really great example of that, because it is both, it's different perspectives. It is offering both of those at the same time, and it's for young people. And I think that it's for young people. It's from the young people's perspective. But I think that, to your point, when people have approached you about the book, they're adults now. And I think that says something about the longevity of the young voice. And I wanted to ask you, when you are writing for middle grade or young adult, how do you approach their voices in a way that's going to be maybe everlasting?
Well, one thing, I don't curse.
Sure.
And I try not to use slang, right? Because it's dated. Mm-hmm. I remember saying fat, and I think it was from the Notebooks of Melanin Sun, and like no one says fat, phat anymore. So, slang gets dated really quickly. And I think when you just speak in language that isn't that, it's more timeless. And I think it was Madeline L'Engle who said the essence of childhood doesn't change, right? The technology around it changes, and the fashion changes, and then changes back. But the essence of what we want is young people. We want to be loved. We want to fit in. We want to be seen. That is timeless. And I think starting with that emotional core of a young person having a desire to be able to be themselves is something that doesn't go away. And that's kind of where I start. But also in terms of thinking about how a 10-year-old speaks, yeah, they might throw in TikTok in 2020, right? But I don't need to put in TikTok and I can still have who they are. You know, I feel like if I had put in Snapchat back in the day or whatever the thing was before Gmail, like if someone was on AOL, like that dates the book.
Yeah.
So I really try to stay away from things that will, you know, I'm not going to put someone in a pair of Air Jordans, and I guess Air Jordans are pretty timeless.
Yeah.
Those are back now.
Yeah.
I'm curious, because you write so honestly and authentically and about difficult issues, both from an adult and kid perspective, I know that there is pushback from adults, you know, in school situations and having access to your work. And I'm wondering how you view that. Does it impact your work? How do you see it?
No, I've never, I don't care. You know, I don't care. It's not going to stop me from writing. It's not going to stop me from sharing the work that I've created with the young people. I always say that, you know, that kind of pushback is about the adults pushing back because of their own deep biases. It's not about what I'm trying to do or say. I'm not doing anything wrong. So that idea of children needing to exist in a kind of kindergarten and, you know, until they can't anymore, you know, and exist kind of oblivious to the world. I don't think that's safe for children. And I don't think children feel safe in that. And I think we need to be honest with young people and hopeful. We're not going to overwhelm them and say the world's going to end tomorrow. But we're going to say, you know, right now we're in a pandemic, and there was a pandemic 100 years ago, and people survived that one, and we'll survive this one. And the world is going to be a little different because of it. And like, because they're looking around them and they're seeing what's happening. And this is even when we're not in a pandemic. And, you know, they see the fear in their family's faces post 2016. They see the bullying that's going on. They see the hatred, you know, and they need to be able to have conversations. I think someone say, whenever I hear like a parent say to their child, "We don't see race," I get very afraid. I just know that there's a lot that's going unspoken that they can't bear witness to. So I feel like the pushback, it's not for me. That's not the fight I'm going to fight. I'm going to fight is a fight that's, you know, how do I get this story on a page in a way that resonates, in a way that's real, in a way that's true, in a way that matters. And then the rest of the work is not mine to do.
We talk about that all the time, especially right now. And Jill had an experience recently with her, the pandemic. And they were really concerned. And I think they noticed the concern in your faces, right, Jill?
Yeah, we talk very openly with our children. And so they were, I think, more aware than maybe most kids. But we got in a whole conversation at the dinner table one night because, you know, I said, well, you know, there was a large pandemic that swept the United States in the early 1900s. And our kids were just blown away. They were like, wait, there were pandemics before? And I was like, yes, yes. And I immediately, well, I texted Michael. I was like, can you imagine facing this situation, thinking it's the first time something like this has ever happened? Like, that's what one of the things I love in your work is that the kids see this. Kids see racism. Right. They're experiencing it. They are living the situation at the border and Dreamers and everything. It's part of their life. It's discussed at the dinner table. And this notion that we can pretend like it doesn't happen or that we don't see it, it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. It is so true.
Yeah. And I'm actually really, really glad we're talking about this because it's reminding me of Harbor Me, which is only came out, I think, 2 years ago. And that is, Jill, to your point, that is about Dreamers and mm-hmm. what is going on literally right now. And it's from the perspective of children. I mean, there's an adult and she leaves them be, and then they have the conversations on their own. And I think that that is powerful. And I think that kids really, obviously kids are going to respond to it, but adults did too. Like, I'm a full adult and I don't know if I would have, I think I preferred that perspective because it offers a sense of honesty mm-hmm. Between young people that a lot of times adults don't allow themselves. And I think mm-hmm. that, could you maybe talk about Harbor Me a little bit and how you came about coming from those perspectives and deciding mm-hmm. to write about what's going on right now?
So Harbor Me is a story of six kids whose teacher, Miss Laverne, they learn differently, and their teacher realizes in her deep brilliance that what they need is a room in which they can talk without any adult energy in it. And so she takes them down to an old art room that's no longer in use in their school. And she says, for 1 hour a day, 1 hour on Fridays, you'll sit here and you'll talk about whatever it is you want to talk about. And then she leaves. And so for me as a writer, I would think it could have been a whole Lord of the Flies thing. Yeah. or it could have been something useful. And so in that room, the young people begin to talk, and they begin to talk about everything that's going on in their lives, and including one kid whose parents are from the Dominican Republic, and he's afraid, he's scared, his father's gone missing. And then another girl whose dad is in prison, and we find out why. Another kid, a black boy, whose dad tells him he can't play with his toy gun in the park anymore. And another kid, a white kid, who's come from a different neighborhood and whose family has gone from being a middle-class family to no longer being middle-class. And it goes on. So all of the, and a kid who's basically, Thiago, who's his mother's translator. Then there's Holly, who has some attention deficit stuff, but also is trying to find her way in a whole other way. So it's a story of, the way in which so many of us are on the outside of other people's narratives and how we find our way. And, you know what, I started writing Harbor Me a long, long time ago. And,
wow.
And I would start it and stop it and start it and stop it. And the reason, and it feels timely, but these things have always been going on. Yep. The history of mass incarceration, the history of deportation, like none of this is new, and so for me it felt like now it was time for this book to really get into the world because I felt like all of these things were all happening on such a magnified level, and the characters felt so much more real to me, and so I really wanted to put it down on, you know, I really wanted to get it out there in this way that did feel timely, even though, again, it's time, like, sadly,
sure,
this is not headline news, although it feels that way, right? So Harbor Me, you know, started and kind of fits and starts, and then it became the book that it is.
I loved Harbor Me, and I was really surprised by it, and I like hearing that. I don't want, well, like isn't the right word, but it proves the point. You saying that you've been working on it for a long time suggests that things are not as different as they should be or as we think they are. And I think that's something that I loved in Harbor Me that then I realized is like really true for a lot of your books. If we're talking age group, it doesn't matter, is the powerful relationship that is friendship. And I'm thinking specifically Another Brooklyn, and then conversely, Before the Ever After. Sorry, it's right on my head. Mm-hmm. Before the Ever After. And then Brown Girl Dreaming, kind of too, but it's a family friendship sort of thing. And even Red at the Bone. I mean, friendship really resonates throughout your work. And I wanted to ask you the difference between friendship as a child and friendship as an adult. Like, how do you approach those things?
You know, young people talk a lot more in their friendships. They're much more candid. They say, you know, they definitely just say what's out there. I think with adults, we are more reticent sometimes. There's more innuendo. It's more sometimes of a physical way of saying we love you. And then there's also what we don't need to say because we know it. Whereas young people aren't quite there of knowing through experience what is meant by actions. So that's how I approach it. I feel like I'm not super conscious when I'm doing it. I'm not saying this is an adult relationship and so therefore it has to happen this way, or this is a relationship between young people, because there is an intersectionality. But I do think about what needs to be said and what doesn't need to be said when I'm writing adult characters, and the same with young people.
That makes me reflective of my friendships.
I have recently read Red at the Bone, and one of the things that struck me about it was that you portrayed in Iris a person who felt stifled by her place in her family, and it seems in motherhood in general, and just didn't immediately switch to, we have this narrative these days, you know, that mothering is like the greatest honor in the world, and as soon as the baby comes out of your body, you're magically in tuned with it. And I appreciated a different perspective. And I wonder, you know, do you hear that from people? It seems like just a rejection of the kind of the norm of how we talk about motherhood. And I loved that she was still loved and accepted by her family, even if they didn't get this thing about her.
I think Iris is so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one thing about it is with her motherhood, she chose it at 15.
Right.
And in keeping with that deep respect of young people, they change their minds. And so she was like, wait a second, this thing is forever. I'm out.
Yeah.
Which kind of would have been me, but also I wasn't going to let her go out without having a foundation that was going to be there to catch the baby. So so hence comes along her family. But it was interesting for me to write that character who is not fully formed yet, creating a new character, both challenging and fun. The other side of that is, and I hadn't meant to tell you this, where the mother is fully formed and decides to leave. You know, so, and I hadn't meant to tell you this, it's a story of two girls being raised by their fathers in Ohio. And it's a very different story of motherhood. And I do think there is this idea that, as you said, Jill, once we give birth, we're supposed to know what to do and we're supposed to want to stay. And that's not always the case. And I remember when I was writing out, I hadn't meant to tell you this, and I was getting mad at the mother for leaving. And my friend Toshi, who reads everything, was like, girl, let that mother leave so she doesn't make her child crazy.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. I think there is something noble about saying, I'm going to get out of your way. And you know, I can't handle this. If I stay, I'm going to hate you. If I stay, you're not going to be the fully formed human being that you can be if you're being raised, if you were to be raised by someone who is more capable of doing this. But right now, I can't be mother. And so, and society is like, whoa, that's a terrible woman. And I think not so much. I think it's someone who knows the right thing to do to save their child.
We, Jill and I talked a lot about how interesting and complex Iris as a character was. And I'm ruminating on all this conversation about challenging conversations, either it being like a macro sense of 9/11 or what was it, the Tulsa race massacre as well? Or on like on a micro sense of schools and cities banning your books. And I believe it was Seth Meyers you were on, and you were talking about how you got a call from, this is the coolest thing in the world, you got a call from Judy Blume, and she told you that your books were being banned. And it reminded me of an interview I watched with Judy Blume when she was doing press for In the Unlikely Event. And the person interviewing asked her, you know, what's it been like to write such controversial work your entire career? And her response was, I don't think my work is controversial.
Exactly.
And I just thought that was so, it gives me chills thinking about. And I was just wondering, like, what is your response to that? Because your books are, to your point, like, there are things that are happening in the world, and these people who are reading them are in the world. So why are they so controversial?
It's so true, because I think people, I'm always surprised that, I mean, you know, If You Come Softly, that was a controversial issue, the interracial relationship, you know, from the notebooks of Melon and Son, a mother coming out was controversial. People thought, I hadn't meant to tell you this, the issue of, you know, the what happens with Lena and her dad. And I'm like, wait a second, but all of this stuff is, again, a part of what happens in our country every day. And and so what makes it controversial is so subjective, right? It's because people are uncomfortable with it, or certain people are uncomfortable with it. But I remember in the 90s when I was first writing, what people, they would talk about my books as issue novels. And it's like, what book isn't an issue novel? And I hated that. And
an issue person, apparently.
That's hysterical. But yeah, what they're saying is that it's something that I am uncomfortable talking with my young people about, or having my young people exposed to. And it makes no sense to me. I always think about how when you're trying to explain something and you have to start from the letter A, right? You have to start from this very remedial place. I feel like me trying to explain that would mean starting from before the letter A. I don't even have the language, because it seems so ridiculous to even have to think about explaining the, what people deem as controversial. Because as Judy Blume said, it's not for me. Right. It's realistic fiction is what it is.
This is just for me, but I'm kind of in love with Seth Meyers. Could you, like, what was he like?
Oh my goodness, he's so lovely. I have all these pictures of my son came with me, because he's in love with him. And he, you know, he gave my son a t-shirt and a hat, and he hugged him, and he, you know, back in the day when we could hug people, and both he and Trevor Noah are just really kind people. Like, I feel like there's beneath the you know, there's the TV personality, and then you hear people who want to get off TV, they're really cruel to people. You didn't get that energy at all. I mean, he just seems like a really nice guy and a really sweet guy. But it makes sense. They're readers, right?
Exactly.
You know, someone who, you look at the talk shows where people aren't talking about books, and you can expect something different from those people. But you look at the talk shows where people are engaging with literature, and, you know, I remember when I went on, you know, when I was talking with Gail King, and she had Red at the Bone, and there were posters like on every page. Like, she did such a deep and careful reading of the book, and you know, and she's, I like her. Like, I like her because she talk about literature, and she is thoughtful about the world. So So yeah, Seth Meyers was lovely, is lovely, lovely, lovely.
Yeah, well, and they're also, you can tell, like, in that interview, and to your point, Trevor Noah and Gail, like, they're all such good listeners. Like, whenever you ask a question, or whenever they ask a question and you'd answer. Sorry, I'm sorry if this is weird. I'm talking about an interview I watched with you. I'm telling you how it was. But they listened, and their follow-up was about your answer. And I think that is reflective of the fact that they are readers and they are listeners. And I loved that interview.
Yeah, thank you.
I think this is the part where we fangirl a little, Joel.
Yes. So, Jacqueline, it started out as an accident and we couldn't control ourselves. But now we're asking everybody we interview who has been in this situation. You're a 4-time Newbery Honor winner and a 4-time National Book Award finalist and a 2-time Coretta Scott King Award winner. What's it like to get that phone call? Like...
that many times.
It's never a bad phone call to get. I do remember when I got it from Brown Girl Dreaming, though, and the Newbery Committee called, and I had not realized that that was the Monday that the awards were being announced, and so you know the phone rings at crack of dawn, and you whenever that happens, you always think, oh, someone's, you know, something's happened to someone. So there's always that moment where your heart skips a beat. And then I pick it up and it's the Newbery Committee and they're all very, very excited. And they're like, you know, we want to tell you that Brown Girl Dreaming has won the Newbery Honor. And I was like, okay, who won the Newbery? I was just like, okay, after 4 times, I'm like, okay, it better be someone good. Because now I'm getting cranky. And it was Kwame Alexander, so I'm like, okay, y'all did good. but it's still like, you know, it's nice. It was great when I got the call about the Astrid Lindgren, because I had no clue that that was a prize that was given to Americans. For some reason, I thought it was an international award, so it wasn't on my radar. I didn't know. When it was announced, I didn't know many. I can't remember if I knew any of the people who'd won, but it just wasn't on my radar in this way. And the phone started ringing at 3 a.m. because they're calling from Sweden. Ooh. And so finally at 6, Juliet, my partner, was up and she picked it up and she's like, it's for you. It's an international call. And it's like the Newbery, but it's all like, Swedish kind of accents calling. They're like, you know, it's the Astrid Lindgren Committee and we wanted you to know that you're this year's prize winner. And I was like, Astrid Lindgren. And they're like, as you know,
as you know,
award comes with, I think it was $6 million, and I was like, wait, what? But I was half asleep, and then it started dawning on me that it's the most money you can win for a children's literature prize. And it was like, which came, I think it was like $650,000 or something.
I always feel like this question garners the best answers. We were talking to Renee Watson a few weeks ago. And she said, you know, they called and the Newbery Committee called, and then the Coretta Scott King Committee called from the same area code a few minutes later. And her initial reaction was, they were calling to tell me just kidding, or like they made a mistake because the area code came up so quickly a second time.
Oh, that's so funny. That is so funny.
I love it.
But I do just want to like take a minute and just say that I first read the first book of yours that I read was Another Brooklyn. And I was on vacation with my husband and we saw a copy of it we were in Provincetown and we saw a copy of it at their local bookstore. And I was like, oh, I've been wanting to read this, but I'm going to wait and buy it at home because I want to support our local indie. And I did. And I went to Joseph Beth and I bought it.
I love Joe Beth so much. Yeah.
I'm so glad I did because it was a signed copy. Because I think you had been there. Not that I might just get a little bit emotional here because I just love your writing. It has really, really impacted me and just changed my life. And I'm just like, I'm just really thankful for you and the work that you put out.
Thank you so much. That completely makes my day. I am thankful for y'all. So this has been really fun.
Yeah, and I don't know if you know much about the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, but we are just a nonprofit in Cincinnati, Ohio. And what we do is for every book that's purchased with us, we donate one to a child in need in Cincinnati. And sorry, I'm going to get emotional again. Wow. I mean, this is me anyway, but whatever. So much of what we hope to do is put the right books into the hands of children. And we're able to do that with the writing that you do. Yeah. So I'm just so thankful for these stories and that they're getting out into the hands of kids in our city that we love so much.
Oh, well, thanks for your work. That means so much to me. And I love that yellow Buckeyes.
Yes, we didn't even get to discuss that you were born in Columbus.
I was. Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah.
All
Ohio
of my
girl.
People are there. My dad's still there. My aunts are there. My cousins. So, yeah, no Buckeye to the bone. There's a lot of, it's still in me, even though I left young, you know, once I started going back when I was older.
Yeah. There's a part in Brown Girl Dreaming when you mention how going back stopped, I think it was your mother who said like going back stopped feeling like going home anymore. And that is so interesting. And I think that I love hearing that you still, you're a Buckeye girl through and through. And my sister lives in Columbus with her husband now, and I'm having her read Brown Girl Dreaming now just because I'm just like, hey, it's my favorite author, and it takes place in Columbus for like a hot second. But yeah, if we could just really quickly talk about Brown Girl Dreaming, because it is a huge, I mean, it's a huge book for you. And what was the experience like for you going through your past to write a memoir in this way for young people, especially?
You know, I didn't know what Brown Girl Dreaming was going to be. I just felt compelled to try to figure out how I'd gone from this place of, you know, being a very slow reader, not being a super academic kid, being from this family that moved from the north to the south to the north, and growing up, you know, both Jehovah's Witnesses and Muslim, like all of these worlds that I existed in, like, how did that help me become a writer, or did it hinder it? And really trying to explore all of that to see how I got to where I am now. And so I just started writing down all the memories I had about being a young person and all the stories I've been told by my parents about our lives early on. And halfway through the book, my mom died suddenly. And I had this idea that when I got to the point where I couldn't remember anymore, I'd ask her and she'd fill in some of the blanks. Because my family was not good about talking, especially about the South. I think the South was very traumatic for a lot of Black people in that way during Jim Crow. So because of that PTSD, there were stories that I had a really hard time getting out of her and my grandma. And then when she died, I realized that I wanted to investigate her life because, you know, without it, I wouldn't be here. So I started shifting the book. And then I went back to South Carolina. I interviewed, you know, all my relatives there, so as many as I could. I interviewed my dad. I, you know, was taking trips back and forth to Ohio. And it was an interesting journey to start putting the pieces together of how I became. And, you know, and understanding, like, my mom and I had, you know, we have her birthday, February 10th, mine is February 12th. My siblings say we're way too much alike to ever be friends. So we had kind of a relationship that was... we struggled and it was interesting to understand her, to come to peace with who she was as a mom and who she was as a person and how much love was in my family. But it was interesting because I thought at some point I thought this is a middle grade book and it never existed as that. I started getting letters from people in Nelsonville, who my grandfather had coached for, he had been a baseball coach, and they're like, yeah, you know, they knew Hope, and you know, so 70-year-old white men, and then, you know, from 11-year-old black boys, and brown girl. I met all these book clubs, and they were brown girls, and they were Indian, and they were Latinas, and they were black. Oh. Like, it hit, and it made, and women my age who the book really resonated with, and it made sense because, you know, it starts in the 60s and goes through to the 70s, but it's a young person telling the story, and it's about, and it's in all of these places. So it had a journey that I never expected it to have, and I'm truly grateful for that.
Yeah, I would say my own experience with it echoes that same thing. I had read it a couple years ago. We didn't have a copy in the house. So in preparation for this, I had ordered a copy and it came and I reread it. And then I handed it, my oldest children are both 11 now. Well, they're nearly 12. And I gave it to both of them over the weekend. I said, oh, please read this. You know, it's so good. And they both read it. And we had some really interesting conversations yesterday, but it is one of those books that it was deep and moving for me, and it was something else for them, but also deep and moving. And then we could talk about it, and it made this bridge, which was so wonderful. It was amazing.
So great.
Yeah.
Jill's house is full of readers.
That's so cool. So you have twins?
I have two sets of twins.
Whoa, bless you.
Our oldest, Pippa and Truman, will be 12 in August, and our younger two are 8 and a half.
Oh, wow. That's great. That is so great.
It gets two responses. Either people are like, that is really cool. Wow. Or people are like, oh, no.
No. Well, having grown up in a family of four kids, I think it's a great thing to, you know, my mom was always like, go play with your sister and brothers. Like, you have plenty of people to play with. And it's like, no, I actually want to play with someone else that's outside my family.
Yes.
But
yes, I will say, if you're going to be pandemic quarantined, a big family is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. It is so true.
Jacqueline Woodson, thank you so much for joining us today. Jacqueline's books include the New York Times bestsellers, The Day You Begin and Harbor Me, The Other Side, Each Kindness, Caldecott Honor Book coming on home soon, Newbery Honor Winner's Feather, Show the Way, and After Tupac and Dee Foster, and Miracle Boys, oh my gosh, which we didn't even get to talk about, which received the LA Times Book Prize and the Coretta Scott King Award, in addition to everything else we have talked about today. You can find her online at JacquelineWoodson.com. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Jacqueline.
Thanks. It was so fun talking to y'all. Stay safe and healthy.
Oh, thank you. You too.
Oh, you too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So, Jill, what did you think of that?
I was really blown away, and I feel silly saying that because I feel like it's what I said when we interviewed Deborah Wiles. It's what I said when we interviewed Renee Watson. But so much of what she has to say is rolling around in my head, mm-hmm. and has been in my mind so much over the past week.
Me too. And something that really I keep thinking about is when we had the conversation around her book, If You Come Softly, which came out in 1998, I'd asked her if she had any idea it would be so relevant 20 plus years later. And she had said, I had hoped it wouldn't, or I had hoped it hadn't, whatever. And we recorded that episode on the same day that George Floyd was murdered by the police. And I don't think it had happened yet when we were interviewing her, either that or it wasn't news yet. And we are recording this a weekend after protests across the country for George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and dozens, if not hundreds, of Black people who mm-hmm. came before them who have died at the hands of the police or any other person in power who they were supposed to be able to trust. And I actually keep thinking, I'm actually a little bit disappointed in myself for even asking her that question, because
I feel like that is a privilege of mine to be surprised that it's still so relevant. And I want to recognize that. I want to recognize that, of course, it's still relevant and that is part of the problem. And I shouldn't have even had to ask that.
Yeah, it is frustrating that we are continuing to have these conversations and that there is so much work to do. It can be hard when we consider ourselves allies and we make mistakes. I think it's important that we acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's hard all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
Her books, especially that book and then also Harbor Me, really kind of both circle around this ongoing conversation that we need to have more of, and we need to, I use the word we, I think what I really mean is white people.
Yes.
Need to talk about these things. And those of us who consider ourselves allies need to be talking to other white people.
Mm-hmm.
While also acknowledging that this is challenging and we are going to make mistakes. We have inherent biases and we're going to have to constantly remind ourselves of it and adjust.
And I think that is actually part of the conversation, is recognizing that we have to be conscious of it, because pretending that we're not conscious of it is part of the problem. Like, it reflects sort of that message of I see no color, as if that is a all lives matter. That's what that message means. And that's missing the point. It's like we need to be conscious about it. When we do book recommendations, we are conscious about making sure that they are diverse voices, Black authors, Asian authors, Native American authors. Like, but pretending that we're not is not helping in any way.
Yeah, I don't know if we've ever explicitly mentioned on Instagram stories, you know, we do a book recommendation video every Monday, and sometimes we also squeeze one in on Thursday and Friday. And I talk it a lot. I have a side gig where I do training for librarians, and I explicitly mention it there. And so I know this is not a thing that other well-intentioned white people are doing, but we very specifically, I will walk around and pick out the three books I want to talk about. And they really are, I choose books that have spoken to me, but I am who I am. And so a lot of times I assemble the pile and I'm like, Jill, gosh, there's a pile of Jill.
Yeah.
And so then I take a step back and I go, no, I've picked the books that look like me. What are other books that I like? I need to diversify this,
right.
And we are very explicit. So we usually review 3 to 4 books, and I don't move forward until I have 1 to 2 diverse choices.
It's always like at least 50% have to be diverse. And
yes,
I think you bring up a good point in that, especially with, you know, I'm gay. I am a member of a minority community, but that doesn't exempt me from making mistakes outside of my community. You know, if my goodness only goes as far as my own reflection, it's not goodness. I have to give a shit about stuff that's happening that doesn't affect me personally. And I think that, to talk again about Jacqueline Woodson's work, again, If You Come Softly, there's a character in it that the story around If You Come Softly, basically, it's a retelling of Romeo and Juliet, and it's a Black boy and a white girl who fall in love and they want to date. And Ellie, the white girl, is afraid to tell her family that she's dating a Black boy because she told her older sister that she was talking to a Black boy. And her older sister is someone who identifies as a lesbian and is going to have a commitment ceremony with her partner. And this person, who should understand and recognize what it means to feel other and being a minority, has a really terrible response to her sister saying she has a crush on a Black boy. And it makes her not trust her family and her sister. And I think that I loved that Jacqueline Woodson put that in there, because Jacqueline Woodson is someone who identifies as queer. And it just brought home the idea that, like, your own suffering doesn't mean that others aren't also suffering, and that, mm-hmm. That we can't we can't only care about what's happening to ourselves. We have to care about what's happening to others.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's one of those situations when you talk about suffering, and I think people are so quick to say, you know, yes, but I'm not racist. And it's like, it's a yes and. Mm-hmm. It's great. I'm glad that you're not actively going out there and being a white supremacist.
Yes.
Unfortunately, we are in a situation where that's not enough.
Exactly.
What are you actively doing? Yes, and you are not discriminating against people in your everyday life. And what else?
Exactly. Like, where are you donating your time or money?
Yeah. And so I think that's the conversation, you know, that is the conversation we need to have with other white people. Mm-hmm. And we are going to make mistakes. You're right. It's just like in this book, and it's our responsibility, and we just mm-hmm. have to own it. We're all there. We're all in it.
So Jacqueline Woodson is currently the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. And she has this quote that she said she takes with her when she's, you know, going to schools or talking to young people. And I just think it's so lovely. And this is what she says. Reading equals hope times change. I do believe that when we read, it gives us hope and it changes us. We're different when we start a book and when we finish it. And I think that her books and her writing really reflect that a lot. I think that we wanted to talk to her about her ability to write for all ages. And I think the thing that we walked away from is recognizing that she keeps in mind the audience who's reading it, because, you know, she's like, I never swear. I don't use references that are too current because that will date the piece really quickly. But she doesn't seem to be too worried about it. And I think that that is reflected in her work. And I think that's what makes her so empathetic as a writer for all ages.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I was struck both when we asked her that question about, you know, she had an answer and there was definitely a way that she approached her work, but also that that's not the focus of her work.
Right. Me too. And I think that when The Day You Begin came out, I'm trying to figure out how to say this. I really don't feel like an outside perspective. It feels really like her stories feel really lived in and real, mm-hmm. even down to the picture books. And I think that she writes from a place of like emotion, clearly. It's all very emotional when you read her work. And I think that that transcends age and experience, because at the end of the day, like child or adult, like we want to be loved and accepted. And I think that like having that at the core of all of her work is what kind of makes it everlasting. And it also makes it kind of feel like she's writing for the reader who is growing up with her. Like mm-hmm. It feels like her picture book is written for the same reader who is then going to read her middle grade books, who is then going to read her young adult books, who is then going to read her adult fiction. Like it feels like she's helping people grow up.
Oh, I love that.
Thanks. Yeah. So do I.
Yeah. No, I hadn't thought about it that way, but I totally agree with you. That's amazing.
Okay, well, thanks. Thanks for listening to Book It.
And that's it. We're done. No, that's really interesting. It's because we had this interview and then everything that happened after it. I had read Harbor Me back when it came out, mm-hmm. and I have loved, of course, Each Kindness and The Day You Begin since they came out. But I was reading some things for the first time and rereading, and then we had our conversation and all of it was so present in my mind. And then this weekend, it was just like the deep dive on Jacqueline Woodson. I read everything we had in the house that I had accumulated before this project. I read it again for that quality that you're talking about. And then it formed the basis of so many of our conversations over the weekend. I was talking with my husband about Brown Girl Dreaming and Red at the Bone. And my kids have read Each Kindness. They're kind of done hearing about it from me, but we read it again at bedtimes this weekend, and I pulled out The Day You Begin, and we had some big conversations with the kids over the weekend. I think it's really important for white parents to have these conversations with their kids, and it's an ongoing thing at our house. That feels It feels hard to start, but once you've brought it up once, you can reintroduce it, and
sure.
It becomes a dialogue in a much easier way. But, you know, we told the kids what was going on, and we really kind of talked it through. And, you know, one of my kids was so upset that they wrote a letter to the police about how angry they were and about how what the police were doing was wrong, and about how we can't, it was, you know, all the language that you hear that I don't, it's just like hearing your own language back, you know, that when you encounter something that's unfamiliar to you, and he was just kind of laying it out. I don't know. That was really powerful for me. So the whole weekend just kind of all became wrapped up in things. And it just felt like Jacqueline Woodson was our roadmap, and we read all the books. You have described it perfectly.
Well, and it's interesting that you say that too, because as an adult, you are figuring out how to have these conversations with your children. And in promotional work that, or promotional interviews that Jacqueline Woodson did for Red at the Bone, people, and maybe she said this to us as well, asked her why did she decide to call it Red at the Bone. And she said, like, because we're still cooking, like we're always becoming. And that is true. I think that's the thing that we don't.
And Michelle Obama says that too.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important lesson to give children, but it's also something that's so important to remember as adults, because when you're a kid, you expect at some point I'm going to be done. Like I'm going to become, I've become. And I think that's why a lot of times there's a lot of disappointment at being a young adult going into adulthood, because it's like, why haven't I become yet? Like what is it? And I think that the reality is that we aren't, and we probably never will. You know, we're all like Disney World. Like, we're never done. Disney World's never done. And giving ourselves room for that to be true and not being disappointed in ourselves is so important. And it's books like the ones that Jacqueline Woodson is writing that give us the freedom to like endlessly become and pass it on to the next generation and then the generation after that. Because you are becoming, and you, Jill, are becoming. And by becoming, you're allowing your kids to have already become in some ways. You're having the conversations that you are figuring out how to have with them. And then they will have an easier time having those conversations because you're figuring it out. Do you know what I mean?
Ugh, let's hope so.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really optimistic about the future exclusively because of the kids that you're raising.
Oh, my word. Well, I am trying like everyone else. Welcome to my parenting podcast. No, it's hard. It's hard, but it's important.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, I don't know. Was it inappropriate for me to like gush over her at the end?
I don't think so.
I'm a little embarrassed about it.
Oh, I thought it was so touching.
Here's the thing. I had a professor in college who, I took an independent study with her, and we had been reading books from an author who I really adore, and my final paper was to write a letter to that author, telling them why I like their work so much. And she had said, like, you don't want to miss your opportunity to tell them what it means to you, because for her favorite author when she was a child was Lloyd Alexander, and she wrote to him when she was a child, and he wrote back to her, and she's remembered that for the rest of her life, and it made such a difference for her. And I think that's what I just think about that all of the time when I think about whenever I have the opportunity to talk to people whose work has affected me in some way, I need to let them know. And that's really where I was coming from, where I was just like, I don't know if I'll ever talk to Jacqueline Woodson again. And I need her to know that like her writing came to me at the exact right time. And I wasn't prepared for how much it was going to affect me and change my life. It absolutely has changed my life.
First of all, who would not want to hear that they had impacted someone in that way? I mean, really?
Fine. Well, Jacqueline, if you're listening to this, I love you.
I do, though, like that we have worked asking authors about Where were you when you found out you won an amazing award into a regular segment on our podcast?
And this time, we also got to be like, what was Seth Meyers like? What was Trevor Noah like? Because I'm like fully, if there's any like positive thing that can come out of this is like Jacqueline Woodson might listen to this. Seth Meyers might listen to this. Trevor Noah might listen to this. Gail might listen to this. We love all of you. Plug Blue Manatee Literacy Project.
Oh, wow.
Nah. Okay, it won't happen, okay? Thank you again, Jacqueline Woodson, for sitting down and talking with us. It was such a pleasure. And also thank you to Penguin for sending us the early readers of her upcoming book, Before the Ever After. Before the Ever After comes out in September, but you can pre-order at bluemanatee.org. If any of these books interest you, you can also order any of them at bluemanatee.org. Don't forget, for every book you purchase with us, we donate one to a child in need in Cincinnati. Bye. Tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast. If you're interested in learning more or donating to the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, you can find us online at bluemanatee.org. If you're in Cincinnati, come by and see us. We're located at 3094 Madison Road in Oakley.